Today actually marks an anniversary of a sort. Last Sunday, the governor announced that people of a certain age were confined to quarters and should not go anywhere. And that announcement applied to me. I found it weird to learn that I was in the age group that is considered high risk for the novel coronavirus. I heard a story in the news about a man who had a severe case of the coronavirus and described him as elderly. He's a year older than me. I remember thinking, wait, I'm elderly? When did that happen? And I know you might be thinking, dude, it takes a long time, so it shouldn't be a surprise, but I don't feel elderly and old. I know of someone, though, who was my age early in the week who happened to be in the grocery store, and the clerk looked at her and said, oh, you're not supposed to be here. And it made me think, oh, great, they're going to start singling out old people. I'm concerned that they're going to put a big red E for elderly on my chest. And, you know, I could picture myself approaching a grocery store and people yelling at me, go away, old person, go home, you know, but hopefully that's not going to happen. So today marks 1 week of being under house arrest for me. I'm going to tell you a secret. Don't tell anyone this, but Lori actually sprang me out of jail one night this week, and we went to Home Depot late at night, and it felt kind of cool to be an escaped prisoner for a bit. But now, as the week went on, things just got more and more difficult, didn't they? By the end of the week, the governor had stated that now everyone is under house arrest, so welcome to my world. Restaurants and theaters are closed. The whole state's on lockdown. Toby and Anna have their house on the market. They're trying to sell it, and then I learned that the new line that realtors are using when showing a house to potential buyers is, can you see yourself being quarantined here? So, unfortunately, you know, at this point, we're kind of dealing with two threats. The one is the obvious threat of the virus. We're supposed to stay away from everybody and wash our hands thoroughly, frequently, not touch our face. And I don't know if it's just me, but is anybody else finding that all of a sudden your face itches more than it ever has before in life? And, you know, it starts itching and you think, well, what am I supposed to do? Just ignore this? I can't ignore it. Am I supposed to go run and wash my hand before I scratch? And I find myself sort of becoming a contortionist, trying to scratch my face without touching with my hands. And it occurred to me that there is one silver lining in the house arrest business, and that's that I now have an excuse to watch more sports on television than I've ever wanted to. Oh, except wait, there are no sports. So what are people doing? One report said they're expecting in about 9 months there's going to be a mini baby boom. It suggested that the most popular names for those babies will probably be Angel, Charmin, and Scott. I hope you saw yesterday's important announcement said the official time to change from your daytime pajamas into your nighttime pajamas is 8 p.m., so make sure you see that. So, you know, our world has drastically changed in the blink of an eye. Just think about, you could imagine a television show, game show, and the MC saying, Johnny, tell our contestant what she's won. You just won an all-expenses-paid 10-day trip to beautiful Italy. Yeah, that's not a prize. That's a sentence. What would be a prize is you've just won a jumbo pack of Charmin toilet paper. Anyway, the second threat of this disease, not just the disease itself, but it's what this is doing to our economy. All of the shutdown is doing unimaginable damage to the economy, and this is worrisome. A poll this week revealed that 75% of Americans are more concerned about the damage to the economy than they are about the disease itself. Nothing like this has ever happened. It's unprecedented. Our son-in-law, Michael, is a pilot for Delta Airlines. They just cut 70% of their flights this week. That means they have 70% more pilots than they need. Pretty ominous implications. Michael actually had a flight this week. He flew to Honolulu and back. The night before he left, we learned that his plane seats, you know, they have capacity maybe 250. They had 166 open seats on that flight. So it was two-thirds empty. How long is that going to go on? So we're concerned about him. Our daughter-in-law, Anna, who really is the main income source right now for Toby and Anna, she works for Emmanuel Tours that does tours to Israel. Oh, wait, Israel has stopped all tours, not allowing tourists in. And so her company has already let go all of their employees in Israel. How long is she going to have her job? Carissa works for a financial services company. Uh-oh, that industry is in trouble. The only one of our kids whose job is not in jeopardy is Toby, emergency physician. His job is secure. The only problem there is his life is in jeopardy. So Lori, because of this, mentioned to me at one point this week, she said, I just feel this sense of heaviness. There's this gloom, this deep concern over where all this is going to go. You know, I talked last week about how to overcome fear, but how do you deal with this uncertainty and this kind of this heaviness that is sort of lying over our nation right now? And, you know, Jesus in Matthew 6, verses 25 through 34, three times said, don't worry. The problem is that's easier said than done, isn't it? But Jesus knew that. And so he didn't just say, don't worry. He knew that if you just say, don't worry, we'll go, okay, I'm not going to worry. But immediately, 30 seconds later, we'll be worrying again. The worry just, if you say, don't worry, it creates a void, and worry just fills right back up in the void. But Jesus gave us something to replace the worry when he went on to say, seek first God's kingdom and his righteousness. Seek to serve and build up God's kingdom and use that as a replacement for the worry. You know, Lori is brilliant in many ways. One of those ways she's brilliant is in dealing with children. Our little granddaughters, Kara and Ella. Kara is now increasingly a two-year-old exerting her will. And so, as you know, two-year-olds have a couple of favorite words. One of them is no and the other is mine. And so when she sees Ella playing with a toy, she immediately wants that toy, and it's mine. And she knows one way of dealing with that, and that is to try to grab the toy and wrest it away from Ella. But Ella is bigger and stronger and can fend her off, push her away, and that usually leads to a cataclysmic volcanic meltdown on Kara's part. And so Lori has suggested to Ella a brilliant strategy. She said, Ella, here's a better way to deal with that that avoids the meltdown. Just offer her another toy, or you go play with something else, and Kara will want the other thing you're playing with, and so you can let her have that, and then go back to playing with what you want to play with. Brilliant. In other words, don't just say no. Replace the thing. And that's kind of what Jesus did. He said, we're focused, we get focused on worrying and what's going to happen, and Jesus said, replace that with something else. With focusing on the kingdom of God. I want to tell you a story this morning from 1 Samuel chapter 4 that I think can maybe inspire us to do what Jesus suggested there. Not suggested, but taught. Prior to this incident in 1 Samuel 14, the people of Israel, who had previously been a theocracy, now suddenly decided they wanted a king. Now, part of the reason they decided they needed a king was that every other nation around them had a king. They want to be like everybody else. But another part of it was they had a constant problem with some of their neighbors. In this case, it was the Philistines, were a constant thorn in their side, kept raiding them, kept launching attacks and invasions against them, were at constant war with them. Israel was kind of in a situation then that they're in today, where their neighbors were constantly harassing them. And so they decided they needed a king who could unify them as a nation, raise up an army, lead the army, and finally deal with the Philistines and get them out of their hair for good. So they chose Saul to be their first king. And he had initially some success against the Philistines. But in chapter 13, the Philistines once again invaded Israeli territory. And 1 Samuel 13:5 says, the Philistines assembled to fight Israel with 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and soldiers as numerous as the sand on the seashore. This is a big army. I mean, how much sand is there on the seashore? How many soldiers is that? Don't know, but it's more than 10. So today they couldn't have all gotten together because of the restrictions, but that's another issue. So compare that with what chapter 14, verse 2 tells us. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men. So he had an army of 600 facing an army of 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and infantry as numerous as the sand on the sea, on the shore. The Philistines not only had huge superiority numerically, they also had a lead in military technology. They had blacksmiths that were adept at making the best swords and spears. And oddly, Israel didn't have any blacksmiths that could make swords and spears. So all they had to fight with were farm implements, axes, plow points, scythes, that kind of sickles, that kind of thing. But in order to make them even moderately useful for combat, they had to take them to Philistine blacksmiths because they didn't have any of their own that could do it. And you've probably heard the adage that came out of that experience, never bring a sickle to a sword fight. Oh, no, that's never bring a knife to a gunfight. But you get the idea, I think. So the Philistines had this great technological advantage. They had great numerical superiority. In chapter 14, the armies were maneuvering and positioning prior to the looming battle. The Philistines were sending out scouting and raiding parties both to gather intelligence and to degrade the Israeli forces. And one detachment of the Philistines had actually established a position on a key pass near a town called Michmash. They had an ideal defensive position there at the top of this pass, which was a narrow pass, and on each side leading up to it, there were these large crags. One of them was called Slippery because it was obviously difficult to climb. We would probably have called it Slippery Rock. The other was called Thorny because it apparently had heavy brush on it with heavy thorns. You couldn't climb either, though, so all they could do was go right up the narrow road into the pass, which meant you were in a completely vulnerable position. So this pass was a choke point. By holding it, that gave the Philistines even more advantage over the Israelis. Now, Jonathan enters the picture. Jonathan was the son of King Saul. He was a noble man. And he looks at the situation. He sees Israel facing an ominous and seemingly hopeless situation. For them to have any chance at all of defeating the Philistines in that situation was going to require something remarkable. And the military problem began with that pass near Michmash. And so Jonathan, looking at the situation, sees that they can't just send the army up there. That won't work, because if they do that, the Philistine guards at the top will just call up for the Philistine armies to enforce the position, and they'll get slaughtered. So he realizes this has got to be a small unit operation to try to attack that pass position. And he comes up with a plan that involves a very small unit. Just him and his armor bearer, the two of them, would attack. The Philistines probably had at least a reinforced platoon up there, which meant 30 to 40 men or maybe more. Jonathan's young armor bearer, who's never named in the story, never named in the scripture, actually I think was a real hero of ancient Israel. A warrior back in those days would have several weapons plus a shield, and he couldn't carry all of it, and so they would have an armor bearer that would come along with them and carry some of the weapons. Problem for the young armor bearer was wherever the warrior went, he had to go. So if the warrior went into the heat of combat, armor bearer went right with him. So Jonathan proposed this aid, the two of them climb up that steep pass and take on a unit, like I said, consisting of at least 30 or 40 men, maybe more. Looked like a suicide mission. They had the disadvantage of trying to go uphill against an entrenched army, enemy. And the rule of thumb in the military is if you attack a force that's in a solid defensive position, you need to outnumber them minimum 3-1 to be able to overcome them. Well, Jonathan and his armor bearer didn't outnumber them 3-1. They were outnumbered maybe 20-1. most likely outcome of this was going to be that Jonathan and his armor bearer were going to die. I love the response of Jonathan's aide to Jonathan's proposal that they attack. He said, "Do all that you have in mind. Go ahead. I am with you heart and soul. I'll follow you to the death." Unbelievable. I'm sure that he thought when he said that, that was what was going to happen. He was going to die. And the amazing thing about this is, even if they were somehow successful in this attack, which seemed preposterous, all they've accomplished is one small skirmish. And the much larger problem of being heavily outnumbered still existed for the entire army. It didn't change anything. But Jonathan said, "I've got to do something." And so he proposed this crazy attack. In verse 6, he said, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Perhaps the Lord will act in our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." Man, there's a couple of critical statements there. The first one is, perhaps the Lord will help us. Perhaps, maybe, perhaps and maybe are not a plan. Jonathan, yeah, maybe he will, but maybe he won't. And if he doesn't, you're toast. You're not going to last 2 minutes. The thing that's amazing to me about Jonathan is he didn't go up there saying, "Well, I'll only go if God promises he'll work on our behalf." He said, "I'm going because it's the right thing to do. It's what God's called me to do. And maybe God will aid us." And here's the cool thing then. Jonathan said, "Nothing can hinder God from saving, whether by many or by few." In other words, if God is going to act, it doesn't take a huge force. It can take just two of us. That's all he needs. I suspect Jonathan was remembering maybe the story of Gideon. You might remember the story where, once again, earlier on in Israel's history, they had been attacked by an overwhelming army. And God raised up Gideon, and Gideon tried to raise up an army, and he raised up 30,000, which was maybe a quarter of the size of the army that he were facing. And God said to him, "Too many, Gideon, get rid of them." And he got it down to 10,000. God said, "Too many," and got it down to 300. And they attacked with 300 men, and God won the battle for them. And I think Jonathan might have been thinking of that as he was considering this attack. He believed that God wanted him to attack the Philistines, and so that's what he did. Verse 12, he says to his young aide, "Come, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Amazing faith. And God used him in a powerful way. Once he got to their position, Jonathan started fighting, and verse 13 says, "The Philistines fell before him." 20 of those men were killed. We're told that it was in an area about a half acre. You know, a football field is about an acre in size. So imagine half a football field, 50 yards down to the goal line. In that space, there were 20 dead Philistines after that little battle. But that, as shocking as that was, there were the remaining soldiers that were up there fled in panic. The result of it was even more amazing. The survivors ran back to the larger camp, and their panic, remember last week saw that fear is contagious, their panic spread, and the whole camp began to panic. Verse 15 says, it was a panic sent by God. This was not a rational thing. They just freaked out, and they began pulling their swords, and in their confusion, started killing each other. You see what happens in verse 20. The rest of the Israeli army sees what's going on, and they mount an attack. Saul and his men assembled and went into battle, and they found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. And the outcome is in verse 23. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel. Israel faced this ominous, depressing, and seemingly hopeless situation. How were they going to deal with this situation? How was Jonathan going to deal with being vastly outnumbered in the first little skirmish? Even if they won that battle, how was that going to help? And yet Jonathan knew God wanted him to act. He believed that he could do something. He had to make a difference. He didn't know how it would all turn out. He couldn't imagine what could happen. And yet he went. And God used him Jonathan trusted God, didn't know for sure what was going to happen, but he trusted God, and God did an amazing thing. That statement in verse 6 is one of the most profound in the Bible. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. God's power is not limited by human ability. He can act even when the task seems impossible for the human resources at hand. So, what does this mean to us? Well, I think in our situation today, what it means is we need to change our mindset. Jonathan didn't see himself as a helpless victim of an impossible situation. He saw himself as a servant of God who could make a difference, even though he didn't know how that could happen. He just knew he had to act, and he believed that if God chose to act, there was no end of the good that he could do. That's kind of what we need to do in these situations. We need to not see ourselves as helpless victims of a seemingly impossible and terrifying situation, but as servants of God who can make a big difference. We need to believe that nothing can hinder God. You know, perhaps we don't have a lot of resources. Perhaps we don't have a lot of power. Maybe there's not a lot of us. Maybe that we don't see much that we can even do to change things. But nothing can hinder God from saving, whether by many or by few. In Matthew 6, verses 14 through 16, Jesus said, "You are the light of the world. A town built on a hill cannot be hidden, neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven." That's common sense, right? You don't put lighting in your house, go to a lot of expense to get lamps and nice lights in the ceiling, and then cover them all up, right? You don't put a light under a bowl. Lori and I happened, before we knew we were going to be confined to quarters, we actually bought a couple of jigsaw puzzles, and we've been doing one of those puzzles. So we have something to do when we're confined to quarters. I know some people think I'd rather do nothing than do a jigsaw puzzle, but here's the thing with a jigsaw puzzle. It doesn't do you any good unless you take the pieces out of the box. Just having a box really is no good. You got to get it out. Jesus is saying you got to take the pieces out of the box. You got to let the light shine. Don't put your light under a bowl. Let it shine. In 2 Corinthians 4, 6, Paul wrote to believers in Jesus, said, "For God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory, God's glory displayed in the face of Christ." We have this light in us. And Jesus said, don't put it under a bowl. Let it shine. Yeah, you know what? Things are gloomy right now. They're dark in a lot of ways. But think about what the dark is. The dark is an opportunity for the light to be even more obvious. You know, if you take a candle out at noon on a bright sunny day and you light it outside, it's not very obvious, is it? But you go out there in the middle of the night and you light that candle in the same place and it becomes glaringly obvious. You can see it from long distances. We just have to let that little light that's in us show in this dark times. In his book, The Rise of Christianity, Rodney Stark says that much of the spread of early Christianity was sparked by the care and compassion of Christians, especially during times of epidemics. Early church historian Eusebius wrote in the 4th century that because of the compassion of Christians in times of crisis, the deeds of Christians are on the lips of everyone. That has continued even to this day. Maybe you've seen the story. There was actually a story about it in the New York Times a few weeks back. The Christians in the city of Wuhan in China have been letting the light shine. Some of them took to wearing these protective yellow suits with the mask and going out into the streets and handing out masks, sharing food, and sharing the good news of Jesus Christ with people. And this was a big deal. One of the residents of the city said about those masks, "Money is useless because you can't find a store that's even selling the mask." And here were these Christians out in the streets giving them away. They gave out over 30,000 masks. Other Christians delivered masks, goggles, and pairs of gloves to the Wuhan Central Hospital. There were other Christians there who noticed that people were actually posting notices on the internet in Wuhan asking, pleading for help and finding medical assistance and beds. And the government censors were actually going and scrubbing those off the internet. And so the Christians actually set up a website to help people find assistance. The citizens of Wuhan started calling them angels in yellow. The Christians were making a difference. If we see ourselves as living for the kingdom of God, we see ourselves as having a chance in this dark time to be a light shining in our world. But I know we all think, well, how can I make a difference? I don't know what to do. I don't have a yellow protective suit. You know, what am I supposed to do? Well, let me suggest just a few things. One is just be an example. You know, people's lives are being turned upside down. They're fearful about the future. They're worried. And they're concerned that things are never going to return to normal. And some are worried about their own health. One of the most important things that we can do is live in peace ourselves. Live out the reality of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. We're walking in a pretty dark valley, but the shepherd is with us. We don't need to fear evil, and I can guarantee you that people are looking for peace right now. And being an example of having hope and having peace in the Lord is going to be huge. You know, I think about, again, our granddaughters. We were with them last Saturday. At one point, little Ella, 4 years old, was telling us about her most recent visit to Disneyland, back when it was still open. She talked about how she went on Space Mountain, and she said when she went that day, she said, "I wanted to be brave." I thought, boy, I need to be like Ella. I want to be brave. I want to be at peace, be like Jonathan, and say, yeah, this is what God wants for us. He has promised that somehow he'll work good even out of things like this, and we can trust in that. So let's be at peace. Second thing that we can do then is pray for people. You know, we can't wave a wand and make this virus suddenly go away. We can't fix the problems that are developing in our economy, but we can pray. Nothing can hinder God from saving, whether by many or by few. So we can ask him to save us, to protect us from this disease, make it go away, somehow keep us all from being financially destroyed. And we can pray for others around us. And here's an interesting thing. Do you know that if you offer to pray for people and ask them what you would like them to pray for you, they will almost never turn you down. People are always happy to have someone pray for them. It makes them feel good to know that someone cares enough to pray about them. So let's pray. And then the third thing is, let's care for those around us. You know, that caring could take the form of just expressing, just offering them an opportunity to offload their worries, just listening to them. Could be seeking to encourage them. You know, right now, people more and more are feeling cut off from others. And so just reaching out, calling them, just checking in with them, texting them, matters a lot to know that someone cares. So let's do that. It might involve physically taking action, maybe helping someone with the chore of going to a store and getting groceries. Maybe it's giving them a roll of toilet paper. I don't know what it is, but I thought that was interesting. There's an article in the newspaper this morning about a growing trend in our country, and that is that people are putting up Christmas lights as a way of trying to cheer up others in these dark times. One woman was quoted, and she said, "Anything I can do to make people happy right now, I'm going to try to do." Wasn't that a great attitude? I'm going to try to help others. That's what she's saying, and that's what Christ wants us to do as we shine a light in this dark world. If you will pray and ask God to show you what he wants you to do, he will put on your heart what he wants you to do. What we need to learn from Jonathan is this way of thinking, based solidly in the confidence that nothing can hinder God from working and that he wants us to be here to spread his light and his love and his hope and his peace in this world. Years ago, back when I wasn't an elderly person, I used to play hockey, and I wasn't very good. Actually, that's not an accurate statement. I was terrible. And so when I played, I had to work really hard and totally focus because I just wasn't good enough. And so all I could do is try hard and be totally there. And I can remember some games where as we got into the third period, and I had, you'd go out on the rink for your shift, I'd come off the rink after my shift, and I would be so exhausted sitting on the bench that my legs would literally be shaking. And it was my turn to go back on the rink. I thought, I don't know if I can skate anymore. My legs are about to collapse. And you go out there and just keep grinding it. Here's the interesting thing about that. During those days, there were many times when money was very tight for us, and I was often stressed about money. I don't remember ever a single moment when I was out there playing in that hockey game where I was stressing about money. I didn't worry about any of it because that game and the effort and the concentration it took occupied all of my attention. And that's what Jesus wants for us, that we will be so focused on his kingdom and on ministering, shining light for him, that we just won't even have time to worry. Yeah, but the little I can do, how much difference is that going to make? Well, in Jonathan's case, made a huge difference. And it can in ours as well. Remember what the great Russian writer Dostoevsky said. He said, if God exists, everything is possible. So I want to encourage you all to keep that mindset. That mindset of, I'm here to be light. I'm not the victim here. I'm God's agent in this world to shed his light and to spread his peace and his hope in this world. I want to encourage you again to tune in to Amy Burkham's Facebook page at noon today and enjoy some music and some worship. They are terrific, as you all know. I want to encourage you. Our church does have, still has to pay its bills, and we have staff we need to pay, maybe one of them. So I want to encourage you to give. You can go to the church website and go to the anchorchurch.us and give. And also I want to encourage you again, keep in touch with one another. Call one another, encourage one another, and we'll see you in a week. Love you all. May God be with you.